The Compliance Perspectives podcast is sponsored by Protiviti, a global consulting firm serving the healthcare industry. Learn more at Protiviti.com. Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives podcast. I'm Adam Turteltaub from the Society Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from New York is Daniel Guerin. Daniel is Chief Ethics and Compliance Officer for Vivint, which is a smart home company. And we're going to talk today about what happens as a compliance officer walking into a crisis. Dan has had a great amount of experience going from company to company, being brought in when they're in the midst of a compliance crisis, and we're looking forward to tapping into it. So first of all, Dan, I know you're traveling today. Thanks for taking time away from your travels to talk to us.
Not at all, Adam. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Now, let's dive into the sort of madness that you've willfully embraced and done so well in. For someone interviewing for a position at a company in the midst of an enforcement action, what questions should you ask during the interview process to get a sense of whether you want to be a part of the remediation team? I mean, what I mean here is, how do you know the company gets it and is willing to do what it takes to truly fix the problem and, you know, isn't looking to you to just put a Band-Aid over it and try and make it go away?
Well, what I would say is in the interview process is that I really split compliance officers, and not that they can't change or adapt their different styles, but there's really peacetime compliance officers and crisis compliance officers. And the peacetime is more like maintenance of a program. It may be still subject to obviously continuous improvement, but it is in a pretty good place. Whereas in a crisis situation, you have a problem that you need to be fixed, and you need to be able to have urgency with calm. So you have urgency in that you need to fix the problem, get on top of things, move quickly. But at the same time, it helps significantly if you can be the calmest person in the room. So during the interview process, that's what I'm really looking for, is can they convey that urgency, but can they still remain calm? Can they come up with a plan? Are they strategic?
And I think calmness is one of those things that, honestly, as you said, there's types of personalities, and you know, people are or aren't that. And if you're not someone who is able to stay calm in these kinds of situations, you really are setting yourself up for not just a professional disaster, but likely a personal one as well. So let's say you're you or somebody you just hired, you've gotten the job, it's day one, you're walking into a company in the midst of a major enforcement action, and you know, and here we're talking not about your sort of day-to-day things, but your crisis situations. Where do you start?
So what you want to start is you want to take an inventory of where you're at. And there's two main buckets to look at. And the first is culture. And then the second is governance and structure. And so did the issue come because there's a culture issue? You know, there's not a culture of compliance and stuff. Or these people were trying to do the right thing, but they just didn't have the correct structure and governance in place, whether that be training, auditing, monitoring, whatever those aspects are. And sometimes it can be both, and that's difficult. But that's the first place you start. I would tell you that if you do have both, start with the culture. It makes everything easier. It's a hard putt. It's a long putt. It's not going to get fixed in a day. And that doesn't mean that you're not working on the governance aspects at the same time. But the culture is so key, that you have the support of not only the board, the management team, and the line employees, but that you're creating alignment amongst them of the so what, in terms of why are we doing what we're doing and why is this a benefit to them. They need to hear that. They need to understand that. And you need to get things moving in the right direction. You're going to get pressed on hard enough from the outside by shareholders, regulators, et cetera. You need to make sure that you have alignment within the company, and creating that alignment is the absolute priority.
And no one should ever underestimate the power of culture. I mean, within an organization, since it affects so much, if you don't have, you know, the right culture behind you, you're really pushing a rock uphill on ice in a snowstorm. It's just not going to be good. Now, as you go about doing the work as a compliance officer in the midst of a remediation effort, there, as I see it, at least two audiences really. One is management and the business unit. You know, you need to keep them focused on the plan while they run their business. And the second audience is the DOJ, SEC, whatever other enforcement authority you're facing. Let's take some time and break those two down. First, how do you keep the business unit on track to do what it needs to do in order to both demonstrate that the company gets it and also integrate compliant practices into the business?
I approach this not as two strategies, but as one strategy. And what I mean by that is what I'm going to do is understand what the problem is. And once you understand what the problem is, you're going to come up with a plan of how you're going to address that problem. And it's building in the data visualization. So you have to come up with the project plan, which can come in the form of a Gantt chart. And you say, okay, look, this is what I understand the problem to be. This is how we're going to fix it. And the way you create alignment with the business is that you're going to break this down to processes. And you're going to still try and make these processes as robust as possible. You want to do them as quickly as possible. I use Kaizen for these purposes. Other people may use Lean or Six Sigma and stuff. But within Kaizen, I use primarily total process improvement or value stream mapping of the two of the principally 17 disciplines within Kaizen. And I use those to make sure that we are building the best process possible for the business while still putting in preventative and detective controls. I layer that over with using a built-in rather than bolt-on approach. Anytime the process owners themselves can operate the controls, you're creating ownership and you're also going to increase the speed. In fact, every time you leave the primary process to have someone check before they can move forward, you're introducing a fault point into the overall process. Sometimes that's necessary. But these pictures become really, really important for the government in terms of them being able to see the data, see how you're addressing it, and giving them the picture. At one minute, they're sitting with me, and in another moment, they may be talking to 20 minutes later an aerospace company, or an hour and a half later, a technology company. And so because of the variety of businesses that they oversee, you need to create the pictures to create that connection with them so they can understand that you understand what the issue is and that you're addressing it.
So as you're talking to those enforcement authorities, you're trying to paint the picture and give them the reassurance that the company is serious about this and this isn't likely to recur. What have you found is most effective in communicating that to them?
I would just go back to my previous answer. It's really the data visualization. It's the picture. So show them the flowchart. Show them like, okay, this is how we onboard a customer. And we were doing something wrong here. And now this is what we're going to do differently. And let me tell you who the control operator are. Let me tell you who the control owner is. And so you get down into the weeds, but you also pull back and give them a full view of the control architecture. And the systems, and you give them the walkthrough. You have to meet them where they're at. You know, often the agency wants to go at a deeper level, but the Department of Justice wants to stay at a higher level. And so with experience, you begin to learn your audiences and how to communicate with them. But again, with them listening to so many different people and participating in so many different meetings, the picture really, really helps bring it home that not only they can understand it, but to prove to them that you understand it because you're able to communicate in such an effective way.
So let's assume all goes well and the terms of the DPA or the settlement are satisfied. What have you found is the key for ensuring that the business people don't say, well, good, we're done. We can go back to the way things were and that they really make this a part of the permanent way in which they do business?
Well, let's go back to the beginning again in terms of we're doing process improvement. So it's not layering in 12 different controls just for the sake of doing it. You're looking at it. So just because you put in a control or you have to like modify a process doesn't mean that you're not identifying business issues. Could be a sourcing issue, could be how the factory's set up, could be how you're onboarding channel partners and stuff. And so you want to bring the greatest speed to value. And so there's no reason for them to walk away because they'll lose those efficiencies at the same point. and the controls are operating within the company, and you're able to show them the benefit of those controls. And that could be less inventory turns, being able to negotiate better because you've consolidated different channel partners. There can be different compliance win-wins. It's not a separate thing when designed properly. It should be cohesive to the business that you're teaching the business how to run better together. And I would change that term. It's not teaching, it's partnering with them. They're getting what they need and I'm getting what I need. When I do this for channel partners, for example, so we have different channel partners throughout the world, often commercial realizes very quickly that what I have in my compliance database is a tool they never have. Because when you have channel partners all over the world, often they're not within your CRM system. You can't see them. The inventory, you can only see the draws and what they're doing in terms of stocking, but you're not able to manage them as carefully. And often when you're trying to, like, if you're sitting up at a headquarters and trying to figure out what's occurring internationally, you have to call someone and they prepare a PowerPoint presentation or something, explains it to you. But when you have a compliance system that's robust, they can just go in and they can take a look at the contract, the audit, everything stored in one place. And so, yes, you have a compliance tool, but you have a commercial tool that doesn't exist anyplace else.
And there's nothing better than those situations where after there's a crisis or just a compliance intervention of some sort where the business unit, A, finds a way to avoid problems, and B, finds itself in a situation where they have better control over their situation. I still remember years ago reading after like a look back at SOX 10 years later, and as painful, as expensive as it was, putting in all those new controls, business people had to admit, you know what, they understood their business a lot better, and it ended up increasing the effectiveness of how they managed it. Well, Dan, thank you so much for sharing all of these insights with us. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA. I hope we're able to expand your compliance perspective.